You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest on my podcast this week is Ellie Portnoy, co-founder and CEO of BackEngine.
Every customer interaction is important. Every customer interaction is thoughtful. Every customer opinion is thoughtful and insightful, but it's not always right. And so you have to make sure you're hearing it from multiple people in multiple places, and then you have to put your own internal sort of like translation layer on top of it, because the customer isn't always right. And I think it's very important to recognize that, but the customer is always insightful.
That's Ellie. We dig into how we turn the pain of scaling into a product that keeps companies connected to what customers actually want. You'll hear how building for 20-year relationships changes every decision, and why customer obsession creates competitive advantage when it's embedded everywhere and not siloed. It's a conversation about preserving founder superpowers at scale, and what happens when you make customer value your only metric. Well, hi, Ellie. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited.
Yeah, that's the same on my end. We're going to talk about the company that you started. And from what I've done some research on you, and I saw that this is not your first company. You did ThinkNear in 2011. You did Sense360 in 2014 till 20. And then in 2023, it became BackEngine.ai, where we're going to talk about in a minute. The question I want to ask you is more about you first. What does give you energy as an entrepreneur?
Yeah. So there is so much about building a company that gives me energy. First of all, the ideation process, the idea that you can think of something, anything, and work to find an idea that creates value, I find it incredibly energizing. But also every piece of the journey is interesting to me, because you have a blank canvas. You have like a wide open opportunity to make this thing whatever you want it to be. And everything is in your control. You can hire the people you want. You can finance it however you want. Like everything is in within your control. And when things aren't working, it's also within your control to make changes and figure it out. And I find that so incredibly empowering. I contrast it with the time I spent working at companies and working for other people. And there you have so many different constraints and so many different people that you have to bring into the journey and keep being all these different like baggage that you have to maneuver and politics. And in a startup, there's none of that. There's really just a right answer. And your goal is just to get to that right answer. And I find that to be the most energizing way of working.
Yeah, exactly. So that's we're going back all the way to your time at Amazon. I can understand that, the politics. I like what you're saying there, and the idea that creates value, because you co-founded and became the CEO of two companies before BackEngine, and then 23 you decided, okay, it's time for something new again, the blank canvas. To start first with, what was the problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution that wasn't available?
Yeah. So across the two companies that I had built, I had experienced the same problem or the same evolution that really bothered me. And it was a visceral pain that I felt as a founder. And that pain is when you're in those early days, you're in a garage, it's just a few people. Founders have this superpower, because As a founder, I needed to sign our first customers. Like, there was no one else to do it. So I was a salesperson. And then when we signed those customers, I needed to make sure that they were having a good experience. So I was the customer success manager. And I also needed to make sure we were building the right thing. So I was the product manager. And what that meant was that I had this incredible view into the customer pain point and the way they were using the product. And that informed how I thought about the product that we built. And I had this incredible ability to bring everything together and make sure that we were, as a company, completely aligned and working towards that goal. And that's a superpower. It means that we were able to really build a great, great, great business and product. And because we did that, we started to grow. We started to bring on more customers. And as soon as we started to bring on more customers, I started to feel like I couldn't do everything anymore. And this is the same story every founder goes through. And so you start hiring people, and you first hire a salesperson and a customer success manager and a product manager. And all of a sudden, the founder starts getting removed from the customer. You start getting removed from what they're saying every day. And all of a sudden, I started to crave their feedback. I started to crave those early days where I knew exactly what was happening. And I felt like I was now making decisions based on anecdotes. There was a layer between me and those customers. And so I would get to hear one or two customers, and I would then extrapolate from that and say, this is what our customer base wants. And I was making mistakes. And then we continued to grow on the backs of those early product decisions that we had made. And I started to get even more disconnected and more disconnected. And then at some point, I just felt like I thought I knew what was happening, but I didn't really. And I definitely knew that superpower that I had in the early days, I had lost. And this happened at ThinkNear. It happened at Sense360. So the idea around BackEngine was, how do we make sure that superpower, we're able to enable and empower any organization at any size to have that same level of visibility? And how do we do it so that it's not just a founder who has that superpower, but it's everyone in the organization? And that's the problem that we've been solving with BackEngine.
Yeah, it's so valuable what you're saying here. Because indeed, you get all these silos, whether they are engineered or not, but everybody hears their stories, doesn't share it. And yeah, these become often the critical pieces that another unit needs to create that magic piece of work, like whether it's in marketing or in services or in product. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's fascinating. And yeah, as the company is growing, that easily gets off the radar. And it turns companies into companies that are undermining their potential, I would almost say, which is a nice bridge to my book, The Remarkable Effect, because that's, yeah, the characteristics that I described there and the traits that I described there almost rely on that level of insight. And it started with focus at the end, but then with the focus, you can do the things that make you stand out in the marketplace. So, you build that in 2023. It started, so that's 2 years in the running right now. Going for, well, this is your third company that you co-founded and run as a CEO. What was there anything you learned from these first two experiences that you say, hey, I'm going to do it different now with BackEngine in terms of possibly the choices you make in the early days? What was a choice that you made early on that appeared to be super powerful or valuable for where you are today?
Yeah, there have been a few things that I've done differently this time. My first couple of times, I was very worried about optics. I was very worried about the decisions I made and how they would be viewed by others. And by that, I mean, like, sometimes I would look at someone that I was thinking of hiring, and I would say, how will investors respond to this? Or I knew that something wasn't working correctly, and I wanted to make a change, but I was worried about, well, what's the team going to think about this? And I just constantly made decisions both from a position of, like, I think this is the right thing, but also, like, what are other people going to think, and how is this going to impact the business in that way? And this time around, I've taken a very, very different approach, which is my only goal is to build a great business. I want to build something that works. I want to solve problems for customers. And I am in the weeds of this, and I'm going to make the decisions that I think need to happen. And I'm not going to focus on investor optics. I'm not going to focus on team optics. I'm not going to focus on any other optics other than what matters. Because I think at the end of the day, if you offer something valuable and desirable, which I know is one of the core traits that from your book, everything else solves itself. Like, it doesn't matter if I hire the person that has the right logos and the right experience that investors are going to love, if ultimately the business doesn't grow. And it
True.
doesn't matter if, like, I keep the team super happy because I'm, like, whatever, doing things that they think matter, but we don't grow, then we're not going to raise more money. We're not going to be a business. So everything just revolves around building something valuable that customers appreciate. And if you do that, investors will love you, the team will love you, everything will be fine. But I had it backwards in my early days.
Yeah, exactly. I called it working towards a situation whereby you create funding freedom because the customers value what you have so much and would hate it if it was gone, that that value will come to you in ways you cannot even forecast for, which then gives you, yeah, the luxury of doing the right things for keeping that going on for the next years to come. And you can stand on your own feet. And then if you want funding, yeah, I mean, you're in the negotiations seat. Talking about you made a link to my book, The Remarkable Effect, and the trade number two of for something valuable and desirable. And I think the two together is where it really happens. Because a lot of companies create something valuable, they solve a valuable problem. But if you then don't have the distinction for a customer to understand, okay, well, but why you and not the other, it needs to be something that they say, yeah, of course you're the obvious choice here because of X, Y, and Z. I saw from my research that you are customer obsessed. And I also found indeed that truth seeking, that providing honest feedback and not just affirmation, but I think you do that both inside your company, but also with your, is also maybe the whole premise of your company, like what back engine exists for. How do you go about it to create something that is both valuable and desirable? Do you have a framework for that? Do you make decisions to say yes or no?
So absolutely. And it's a very, very hard thing to be an entrepreneur building something new because it's so easy to get focused on what the technology can do and how cool you can make the product. And it's very easy to, like, sort of put yourself in, like, your own insulated environment and get just super excited with your own co-founder and your own team and, like, build something super cool that doesn't actually solve any problem and isn't valuable and isn't desirable. So the best way I know for making something that is actually valuable and desirable is to work extremely closely with our customers and our prospects and listen very, very closely what they're saying and what pains they're trying to solve. And so I learned that, you asked me before, what are some of the things that I've done differently? My first companies, whenever I talked to customers, my questions were like, would this be valuable to you? Would you like this? And now my questions are, what are your pains? What are you trying to solve? What are you trying to, and that difference in framing makes it so much easier to really hear what customers are saying and make sure that you're not just basically trying to get, like, a yes, I like this, and you're trying to understand what is it that they're actually trying to solve so that you can solve it, because that's the best way to get to value and desirability. And so in terms of frameworks, it's just start with the customer, listen to the customer, ask the right types of questions, and basically, like, iterate with them. So once you build the thing that you think they want, put it in front of them, watch them really closely, see if they're actually using it the way you want it to, talk to them continuously, and almost think of every customer as a design partner, a partner that's helping you
True.
build this product.
Yeah, exactly. It always starts with the problem. Have you recognized or realized that customers aren't that well prepared or well occupied to display or to explain the problem?
Yeah, I think so, because I put myself in the shoes of a customer, and a customer typically has lots and lots of things going on. They have lots of problems, and they also have lots of day-to-day responsibilities, and they have lots of things that occupy their mind, both professional and personal. And so when they t articulate a problem, it's one of many problems, and it's probably something that they haven't had a chance to spend a huge amount of time thinking about.
Exactly.
And they also don't have the exposure or the experience to know what, how does this problem manifest itself across other companies. So they're seeing it from a very isolated standpoint. And so they're expressing it in the context of, like, how it's affecting them, which is, can sometimes be dangerous if you then try to apply it everywhere. So my my rule of thumb around customer feedback is every customer interaction is important. Every customer interaction is thoughtful. Every customer opinion is thoughtful and insightful, but it's not always right. And so you have to make sure you're hearing it from multiple people in multiple places. And then you have to put your own internal sort of like translation layer on top of it, because the customer isn't always right. And I think it's very important to recognize that, but the customer is always insightful.
Let me make a small interruption here. Eli just made a remark that sets his approach apart from conventional startup thinking. Every customer opinion is thoughtful and insightful, but not always right. This distinction separates founders who listen to customers from those who blindly follow them. And this is what remarkable software companies do. They acknowledge they cannot please everyone. Then they focus on the essence. And with that, they create fans, not just customers. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. That's, I think, the right way to nuance it. Yeah, exactly. Because it's their context that they are displaying, which is their reality. But yeah, very often what you see at the end is that they are touching on the surface of the problem, and it's your task at the end. But that comes also from talking to different companies to figure out like what's really underneath at the root cause of it. Fascinating. Go well. Talking about your you then build a product. You get it to market, but as you, I'm not sure anybody actually talked about it in the beginning of this podcast or just before it, but startups, you don't have endless resources, resources both people and money-wise. How do you ensure that you start an area where the traction happens the fastest?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's so hard to answer this question because every startup is resource constrained, completely resource constrained. And there is just a lot of things that you need to build just to get to like a baseline MVP product, especially if you're selling to like other businesses or you're selling to the enterprise. There's just like such a high bar for what you need to do. And most of the time, it's really, really hard to even do that one thing well, let alone like a whole slew of solutions. So what I've tried to do is I've tried to really hone in on what is the problem that someone would pay to solve, even if it is the only problem that I solve. And that means going very, very specifically down to like the minutest level of the problem that they're trying to solve. And then you can work your way up. And when I think about the businesses that I've built, I've really tried to find that very, very specific granular pain point that people will pay to solve, but that is a problem that if I solve it can lead me to solve other problems. Because I've gotten stuck on this in the past where I built something that was valuable that people would pay for, but it didn't let me expand beyond that. And if you get to such a myopic pain point and then there's no way to expand from it, you're really not going to build a great business. So it's balancing finding a myopic thing that you can solve today with limited resources. But if you solve it well, you put yourself in a position that if you have additional funding and resources, you can expand from there and build something really valuable.
Super valuable insight there. Yeah. Have you got a framework for that to sort of envision the future based on where you start today with a particular problem?
Oh, I wish I did. It is such a hard problem. Some of this is just more art than science, which makes it harder to come up with frameworks. And I only have 3 data points, which I know is a lot for startups, but it's still only 3 data points. So it's hard to extrapolate from that and come up with a framework.
Okay. So what are these data points that you focus on?
So we basically uncovered that there was a huge amount of people using their mobile phones. Like mobile usage was exploding. This is 2011. So the iPhone was a couple of years old.
Yeah.
And advertisers really wanted to find the way to basically use this new medium to reach people. And we came in and we said, well, we think the way you can do that is through location. You could do it much better. If you understand where someone is, you can show them more targeted ads. And that was the basic hypothesis. And turns out that was a big enough market and a big enough problem that we lucked into it. It wasn't that I thought about this or had this framework. We lucked into it. At Sense360, the idea was, hey, we think that all of this new data that's being created as everything goes digital is actually super interesting for businesses to better understand their consumer and their customer. And so we started to build these real-time dashboards. The problem there that we got stuck on was that every business type, every business vertical had different things that they wanted to look at. And so we would come in and we would basically solve a pain point for a vertical, let's say restaurants, but then we would have a very tough time expanding within restaurants too. We could answer more and more questions, but there was a limited amount of budget every one of these companies could pay for. And to really expand the business, we needed to move into other verticals, but we were not in a position to seamlessly move from one vertical to the next. And so that was a very big learning that I've taken into the back engine, which is the voice of the customer, basically understanding what your customers care about, which is ultimately what we're solving for, is a very wide-ranging problem where if we can solve it myopically for one company and help them understand the customer, there are all these other teams within that company that want to get access to that voice of the customer. So we're able to find ways of expanding internally. And then across verticals, there's also the similar pain where it's a pretty universal desire to understand your
Exactly.
customer because every business needs this. So yeah, those are my three data points.
Yeah, and I completely understand that. And I also liked how you build it up because you start to see different patterns and different things that are important. But your last one is a crucial one. It's that growing internally in a company and also have the ability to grow to adjacent sectors where you solve the same problem, but just maybe in a different, little different of nuance. But that comes to a big point at the end, going back to the resourcing. Trait number one in my book, acknowledge you cannot please everyone. Where do you decide to focus first? Because I see so many companies making the mistake, say, yeah, well, it is a horizontal solution. It's the voice of the customer. It can be for everybody. So we are for everybody.
Yeah. This was a mistake that I made on the other extreme at my last company, and one that I think I've gotten to a better understanding of for this one. So at Sense360, I was hyper focused on getting very, very myopic. So our ICP was quick service restaurants, not just like any restaurant, but quick service restaurants, which means not full dining, not casual dining, with over 200 locations based in the US. So that was way, way, way too narrow because we didn't have a great way to expand then to restaurants with less locations and restaurants that weren't casual. So we ended up being like basically taking this rule, the acknowledge they can't please everyone to the extreme, and then finding ourselves stuck. At Backengine, we have a much more horizontal play that theoretically could work across all sectors of the business. And we've decided to be intentionally constrained, which has actually been a more helpful way to constrain ourselves because I don't think it stops us later from expanding. And that is, we're exclusively focused on B2B, predominantly focused on SaaS. So not just like B2B agencies and B2B, like all sorts of other businesses, but SaaS. And then within SaaS, we're focused on companies that are roughly Series B to Series D. So think, $5 to $10 million in ARR to about $250 million of ARR. That have a customer success team and where their relationships are large. So ACVs over $25,000. And so those are a lot of constraints that we put in place, but they're
Perfect.
also, they help us focus, they help us make sure we're building the right product, but they're also constraints that I can pull out over time and I know the product will still work. So again, I don't know if I've gotten it right, but at least those are the lessons I've learned from the
You're doing the right things
ventures.
there, you know? It's typically making it almost so narrow that you start to kind of feel itchy about it. But what you're doing here is you're zooming into a problem that, the way I hear it, is both valuable for these companies, but also on the critical side, because you could solve for smaller or for other use cases, but then probably might be still valuable to solve, but not critical. And if it's not critical, it's a nice to have. But for those companies, it's like, yeah, it's a high priority on the list. Because if we fail here, our company is going down the drain. So, and that's what it's all about at the end. It's this triangle. In my book, I'm talking about it on page 34. Look at all your problems that you solve. Which are the most valuable ones? Which are the most critical ones? And then which are the ones that you could solve better than anyone else? Meaning you become sort of the only logical choice. And if that's the type three times yes or three times high, you're in a very good part of the business. Very good. Another aspect that I saw from my research, customer obsessed, which to me also means that you don't only want to have customers, but you want to have customers that keep coming back and talk about you, which is aligning with number six in my book, Trait Number Six. Remarkable software companies create fans, not just customers. What is your philosophy around that?
If you believe that the ultimate way to grow and build value is to make sure that you are delivering something that solves problems for customers, then your entire obsession should be about those customers and making sure that you are actually delivering that value to those customers. Again, we talked about optics at the beginning. If you're more worried about like what your revenue looks like this quarter, and you think like that'll get you the funding and then you're going to be in a great place and like then you'll figure it out, then sure, don't obsess about your customers. But if what you're fundamentally worried about are the things that will actually drive the business to be great, then it all starts with the customer. And the way I would express this at my companies is I talk about building 20-year relationships with customers. And the idea is when I go on a cruise ship and I know I'm going to be with people for 7 days, and then at the end of the 7 days, I'm never going to see them again, I interact with them in a much more transactional basis. But when I think about my neighbors, my home, the people who live next to me, I know that's going to be a, 10, 20, 30-year relationship. I am much more focused on the long run. If they need something, I'm more than happy to give them eggs. If I need something, it's not so tit for tat. It's just a relationship. And I want us to think about our customers the same way, which is we're trying to solve their problems. We're not trying to extract value. We're trying to create value because we're going to be working with them for 20 years. Even if they don't end up working with us for 20 years, I want us to take the mindset. And what ends up happening if you take that mindset with those customers, if you're focused on solving their problems, if you're not focused on extracting value, but delivering value, if you're don't get upset about like the day-to-day, because there's always like in any relationship, there's going to be ups and downs, and like, they're going to need something from you and you're going to need something from them. Like I've a perfect example is like COVID happens and customers are like, oh my God, I need you to work with me because I can't pay you for the next 3 months. And like if you're very transactional, like, no, it's a contract you have, but like that's not going to help anyone. And similarly, like you're building software, at some point you're going to have downtime or you're going to mess something up or you're going to have a release that doesn't go well. And you want them to give you the benefit of the doubt and say, we're also in this for the long run. And so by taking that 20-year approach, that mindset changes everything. And it helps you again go back to, making sure that you're delivering value. And when you do that, I think everything else takes care of itself.
I love that mindset. Never thought about it that way, but yeah, well, implicitly, but it is so true. Because there's so many companies that, and it also sometimes changes, right? When the ownership is changing, for example, a company that's private goes to public, IPO or private equity, these things dynamics often change as well. If you don't look out. But you're right. It is all about that, and it works two ways because the moment you mess up, they'll back you up as well. Do you have an anecdote of when this really worked for you in a unexpected way, where that fan status or that customer for life status surprised everybody in the company?
All the time. The most obvious example is when the customers start making referrals for you. They start reaching out and saying, "We have a customer. We think you should talk to this vendor that we work with because they're awesome." Like that happens all the time when you create super fans, and that is the thing that makes me the most happy. But it shows up in other ways. Like if you want someone to do a case study and they're happy to do it when you're working through a renewal and you've got like actual partners who are working with you to try and figure out how to make it happen, when you mess up and they're willing to like give you another go, when there's just so many manifestations of really customer, if you treat them as transactional partners, they will be transactional. When you mess up, they will leave you. And when you need to raise the price, they will leave you. And when there's another vendor that comes along that with a shiny new thing, they will leave you. You treat them like true relationship partners. They end up being exactly that, which is they want to help you. They want to see you succeed. They want to give you the feedback. They want to make sure that others know about you. And that is the type of relationship that I think you need to. And so specific stories, yeah, like This week, two different customers for Backengine reached out and said, "Hey, by the way, I just showed someone the product at another company. He's a friend of mine. They want to have a demo with you." Like that happened this week twice. We have customers who have tried to get jobs with us. We like all of that are like examples of stories of what it feels like when you can really build customer obsession.
Yeah, exactly. I love those type of anecdotes. In terms of time, one thing I started to think about in relation to creating fans, not customers, in my research and what you've also built in the past, I've also realized that you're much more about, well, a lot of about you is about category creation. Is that correct?
It is. I don't try to create categories, but yes, the
But
businesses that I've built have required it.
But then at the end, it also starts with that mindset of 20 years, well, building relations that last, where people actually do the work for you so that category is creating itself. It's almost like a movement that you're creating. What have you learned that's been very valuable for you in terms of creating the new categories? And possibly what have you learned that you say, okay, I made this big mistake, never do that again?
I mean, the first thing with category creation is you have to have a unique point of view about what something should look like. And it has to be unique because otherwise, if it's not unique, then you're not creating a category. And you
Yeah,
have to
true.
really refine what is it about what you believe, what insight you have that's different from the rest of the market, and how can you use that to solve customer pain? And if you do that, then you have the beginnings of a new category. And then the next step is you have to go and evangelize that. So you have to do a lot of work to both refine your thinking, but then also go out there and talk about your point of view and why your point of view matters, and then stress test the point of view, make sure other people start to agree with you, and then get it out there as wide and as far as you possibly can. And if you do those things, the category starts to get created. All of a sudden, I remember at ThinkNear, I talked about this idea that mobile was the new cookie, or location was the new cookie. And I had like a real strong point of view around why that was important, why, the cookie, which is a technology that advertisers were using on the online and desktop advertising world to basically track people and figure out what they cared about and what they should be shown. And my point was like, that doesn't work in a mobile environment for a whole bunch of reasons, some of them technical, but some of them just like from a usability standpoint, it was silly. I was like, but location is the new version of that because if you understand where someone is, you can actually make some really good targeting decisions. And I would say that, and I would talk at conferences and I would do all this stuff. And then at some point, I started hearing people say it back to me. And I was like, okay, we're creating a category because now people are saying it back. People are talking about this on their own. And I think that's what it feels like when you've started to at the beginning stages of creating a category.
True, exactly. Yeah, the point of view is really important. So what is the point of view that you have for back engine? What is that thing that you are strong about where others might not completely agree with?
Yeah, there are two things. They're both very interrelated. The first one is that the voice of the customer, the like being able to hear what customers are saying is something that matters not just to one team, but matters to every single person at the organization. And that it is imperative for the organization to make sure that everyone is hearing it. And there's a lot of companies that are working on the voice of the customer in B2B. And almost all of them are focused on a specific team. They're focused on the product team. They're focused on the customer success team. And to me, that voice of the customer is a common language that needs to align every single person around the company. And so that's one thing. The second thing is that the voice of the customer is a living, breathing organism that needs to be embedded in every part, every decision that the organization makes. So it's not just that the different people care about it, but it needs to actually work inside the tools that those people are already using. So the product manager who's writing PRDs and prioritizing stuff and using things like Pendo or Product Board, like the voice of the customer has to live there. And the CS team that's using a Gainsight or a Tatango, they need the voice of the customer living in there. And the CEO needs it in their BI tool. And so those are two of the very big point of views that we have that we've been evangelizing and making sure that people hear and understand. And that's how our product is set up to work.
Makes total sense. It really aligns with the chapter I wrote in my book on trait number 9, sell the idea, not the product. And the idea is what people are are connecting to. Okay, last question then. Based on all your experience as starting and founding new software companies and leading them towards success, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other aspiring for people that aspire similar success?
That's a great question. On the do side, I would say we live in such a unique moment in history where there's such an opportunity to build companies, both because there's infrastructure for us. We can rely on AWS and we can rely on OpenAI and we can rely on all these tools. So it's just so much easier to build, but also because there's so much content and thought leadership out there about how to do things and how to learn from other people's mistakes so you don't have to make the mistakes yourself. So it's a really, really good time to build a company, and it's an incredibly rewarding journey. So if you're thinking about it, don't think about it so much. Just go out and do. Put something out there and like start the process, because I really think it's a rewarding and a super opportune time to do it. On the don't, I'd go back to what I talked about with optics. It's just so easy to think that there is a best practice or a right way to do something and to get really focused on like what will, like optically, how do I make this look like it's working so that I attract investors, teammates. And I just think that's the wrong approach. I think there's too much to do and there should only be one focus. And that focus should be, how do I create value for our customers? If you create value for your customers, everything else falls into place. So that would be like my don't, is don't lose sight of that.
Very good. Perfect. Well, thanks for sharing all the wisdom and the things that you learned over the last, what is it, almost 15 years of entrepreneurship. Where can people go to find out more about BackEngine or to say hi to you?
BackEngine.ai. They can reach out to me at eli@backengine.ai, and they can find me on LinkedIn. It's linkedin.com/ELI Portnoy.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Eli. And I'll keep following you on the journey. Thanks.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
And this wraps up my conversation with Eli Portnoy, co-founder and CEO of BackEngine. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Ton. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.